You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. One of my favorites is on the show today. I mean,
Lord of the Rings,
Goonies, Rudy, Stranger Things 2. I didn't see that one. He's been in everything, and I got to tell you, this guy's a mensch. He is just a sweetheart. His father, his father was Gomez Adams. Is it John Austin, I believe?
John Austin.
Guess who his mother was? Patty Duke. I mean, he grew up with kind of like royalty, Hollywood royalty. And he tells great stories. I didn't care if he repeated a story. I wanted to hear these stories. I wanted to hear when he auditioned for Goonies. I wanted to hear when he got these amazing roles. And the stories, the pictures that he paints are just, I could listen to him forever. I don't know if there's more to say to this than that. By the way, Tom Welling and I will be in Boston and Toronto in August. And Kristen Krug and Tom and I will be in Toronto. In August, and Left and Laurel, our album's coming out very soon, so be on the lookout for that. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Let's get inside of Sean Astin.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Why does she stay with you?
Why does she stay with me?
Yeah.
You're talking about my assistant, Jess?
Is that your assistant?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, she stays with me because without her, I think I'd probably completely fall apart.
Oh, not probably. Because we were thinking of starting a podcast at my house, and I bet she'd come work for us. I'm just saying.
Are you another actor who wants to start a fucking podcast? Everybody wants to start a podcast.
No, I did a podcast before you did a podcast. It wasn't a podcast. I called it a radio show. Notice the air quotes.
Really?
Yeah.
I think you'd be, incredibly successful. I think people would really listen to your podcast.
No, I did a show called Vox Populi Radio, Voice of the Occasionally Interested People. Vox Populi means voice of the people. And
yeah,
and it was the idea was civil discourse. So I did one season out of Toad Hop. You remember what Toad Hop was?
No.
That name doesn't sound ring a bell. Okay.
I know Rob doesn't. He was born in 2008.
No. You were born into it? No, he wasn't.
No,
born
he's
into
29.
That.
He's got two kids.
30.
I know. You tell your face. Your face doesn't know yet. But no, the John Lovitz Theater.
Oh, yeah, I know. Universal.
And on the third floor, they kind of retrofitted two little rooms to be like a little radio studio. And it was Frank and Heidi, who are KLOS now. Frank and Heidi were big personalities, and they either got fired or their station got folded in or whatever. So they were kind of like, and this is like 15 years ago. So maybe not that long, but it was a long time ago.
I
went there and said, listen, I want to do this political radio show. And they kind of looked me up and down and were like, okay, fine. Congratulations.
What year is this?
I can't remember. I want to say it was like 2010, 11, 12.
And did you get paid for this radio show?
No. And if I would have had, some help, you see what I'm saying? Then maybe.
Right, first of all, if you're looking at, like, you pointed to my producer, Rob, here's what happened. Yeah. Every time.
Yeah.
So here's, I'm starting to have this feeling. Maybe it's because, look, I'm going to therapy and I'm starting, but I feel like.
I can totally help you.
I feel like, Rob got me to do a podcast. He said, where this is going.
2 years ago, yeah, we started this.
Right. Well, really, for the last year, we've been going strong. And everybody that would come to the house would be like, oh, this is cool. And you got the setup and So Nick Swartzen was like, hey, can you help me, Rob? And then all of a sudden, somebody else would come over. Oh, yeah, Rob, you're really good. And then my friend Dax comes for an interview and goes, man, I really like this. Gave me the idea to have a podcast. Yeah. So Dax goes, hey, can I use your buddy Rob? So Rob goes with Dax. Oh. And all of a sudden, no, this is great. But what I'm saying is everybody, once they see it, has now wanted
Can I help you?
I'll give you my card and we can talk after the show.
This is what
you
need.
And every podcast he's helped out is doing better than mine.
This is what you need to
do. That's the fucking reality. Why?
No, you've done something here and you're not even acknowledging what you've created.
What?
You're a radio station. All these friends, you can help with the administrative piece of this little venture. And then they don't have to even think about it. So instead of thinking as like farming him out to a bunch of different people, it's they are all coming to take a piece of his time as you mount a station.
Jesus. By the way, you talked about politics a minute ago. I don't talk about politics on the show because I think it's a relief not to.
Okay.
He loves Trump.
He doesn't? Are you a Trump guy?
He's a big Trump supporter.
Do you know where he is right now? Oh, when is this going to air? I don't know.
No. Rob,
you think
are you
he'll be president when
I say listen, I'm extremely liberal. No, that's not true either. I'm not that liberal. I go with the best person for the job. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Mm-hmm. He's got a Bernie Sanders tattoo on his chest.
I'm not saying anybody I like to. I don't talk politics. I don't want to go in there and it's like oversaturated with like all these actors. You know, nobody wants to hear fucking actors talk about politics. Now, I understand it's important. For a person, just because you're an actor doesn't mean you shouldn't have a voice, right? Because that's what us actors will say. It's like, what, now that I'm an actor, I don't get to speak up about politics?
Well, I think the problem that people have is listening to actors talk about politics stupidly.
Yes, things that they like, don't. You're right. I don't know enough about politics and what's going on. I mean, I sort of do to pontificate. But you're a graduate of a highly successful university. What is it?
UCLA, right down the street here.
Yes, yeah. And you also didn't you do like study literature and?
Oh yeah, literature and history or American literature and culture.
So and you're like
I've got a vocabulary, bro. If we wanted to throw it down right now,
I can do
like,
it.
SAT. You know what I'm doing?
I'm an idiot.
Right? You're not an idiot.
I'm incredibly creative and witty and self-deprecating.
Talented.
I would say that I'm talented, but I would say that I'm not book smart. I don't have a ton of common sense.
That covers the whole gamut. You just did the whole. It's usually you think a guy's book smart or he has street sense. You've got neither.
No, I think I'm just really witty and funny and creative and right. Charming.
I think that's street sense. I think you have street sense.
Yeah, okay, street sense. Yeah. But yeah, look, we know you're a smart guy. I think people really. Here's the thing. There's very few people I'll say this about. None of the guests I've had really have what you have, except for Henry Winkler.
Gut?
No.
Henry Winkler. Now.
Well, how old are you? 48?
Yeah, 48. Yeah.
I'll be 47. You know, you can have a gut if you want. You can have a gut. You have three kids.
I don't want it. It's really annoying. It's so annoying.
But I've seen you here's the thing. You're like a chameleon. You're like the Tom Hanks. You're like the, what's an actor that gets heavier and then skinnier and then medium-sized?
De Niro.
De Niro. You are a De Niro.
I am De Niro. That's when you think of Goonies, you think that guy.
You know what?
Is De Niro.
I think that you know, I've seen you in amazing shape. We talked about the marathon you ran.
Yeah, the triathlon.
The triathlon, yeah. Which was like the craziest story I've ever heard, which we can get into that. But before I get into that. Oh my God! It's one of the most amazing achievements I think anybody can ever do, and I really couldn't do it. I think
what you're saying is true for most of my life in my professional.
Oh, by the way, sorry, I want to cut you off because what I was saying about Henry Winkler is you're one of the nicest guys around. That's what I wanted to say. So go ahead.
Henry Winkler's an asshole.
No, he's not.
I've met him, and he's a hero of mine. And his children's books, and he's just like I've seen him interact with. Lots of fans and lots of different settings, and he's just always so. Yes, Henry Winkler is. I will defer to Henry as the nicest person in show business.
Is it just innate? Is it something that is it? Do you? This is an important question for me because I'm always asking questions that reflect maybe my life or why I am not. Do you think that your childhood was the main component to who you are now? Do you think it was like you had, was your childhood great? Was your family kind? Were they loving,
Do you
loving,
know anything
supportive?
About my particular, I mean, are you asking a general question or a specific question? Because these hills, this Wonderland Avenue right around the corner from here, and these hills are kind of like, I was reared in these hills. Well, not exactly, but close. Actually, I was driving up there because I was a little early, and I looked down and I could see Sierra Towers. Do you know what CR Towers
is?
The really tall building right at Sunset Doheny. The super tall one, the one on the south side of the street.
Yes,
white one that with those weird kind of...
Yeah.
That was, so I was conceived in that building.
Really?
Yeah.
In an apartment building?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, I don't know if that's exactly where I was conceived, but it, my mom was living there.
Patty Duke.
Patty Duke is
not
my mom.
Just your mom.
Yeah.
Patty Duke.
Yeah. A funny story was she came down. First of all, she was short, like real, like 4'11", 4'10".
And what are you, 5'9"?
I'm 5'7". Whatever.
Well, that hasn't hindered your career yet. Or whatever.
No. It's been
helpful.
It's been very helpful.
I mean, Lord of the Rings, I don't think if you were 6 foot four,
no,
you'd be, yeah.
No, I played a Hobbit, and Rudy was too small to get on the football team, and
God.
I did Memphis Belle, which was, I played the character who went in the ball turret on the B-17 bomber, which is, you have to be really short to get in there, so being short been very good to me. But I was going to just tell you this little story, it pops into my head. My mom goes down, and there's like a doorman, you know, the car, 1970, and she jumps in a car and takes off. And she finally is into Beverly Hills, and she pulls over, and she doesn't know what the heck's going on. And she realizes there are these blocks strapped to the pedals. She had jumped in Willie Shoemaker's car, the jockey, the world famous. Because they're both short, and I guess they had a similar car. So, you know, it was like, she didn't get, it wasn't Grand Theft Auto, because in those days you were just like, oh, hey, here's a bottle of wine, and it's fine. But
sorry.
Yeah, but no, I mean, I think in terms of the thing you're talking about, I mean, my mom was a very famous bipolar sufferer. She wrote books and gave speeches, and Larry King would always have, when some awful incident would happen and it was mental health related, my mom and Muriel Hemingway and I can't remember who the other one was, but they were the kind of go-to national figures for talking about depression and bipolar disorders.
And it probably wasn't as big as it is now, where people are really starting to open up a little more about...
She's credited with being
the first, the pioneer.
In terms of bipolar disorder. There's others before her who really opened about their depression and that kind of thing. But yeah, in this kind of new market era of talking about the, you know, the psychiatric, the kind of index of things, anxiety and all these things, bipolar was one of the ones that was really taboo.
Could you define bipolar in like a sentence or two for people who don't know exactly what bipolar is?
Well, my mom would always just kind of distill it into the idea that there was a chemical imbalance in her brain. And the medicine that she took, the lithium or the Lamictal that she took, helped. You know, lithium is an element. It's one of the it's a metal, right? So apparently, there's something in the and this is in my own investigation of this with psychiatrists and stuff. I have been really shocked to see the lack of a vocabulary for average people, like for lay people. You can't. It's very hard to put into it. But basically, it's. They'll give you a list. If you look at that big, there's a gray book, the psychiatric, whatever it's called.
It's the most known psychiatric book.
Well, it's the book. It's this big, huge telephone-looking book of psychiatric disorders. And if you go to bipolar and you open it up and there's like a list of 12 behaviors that are indicated with it, you know, depression is one, euphoria, sexual promiscuity, erratic spending, delusions of grandeur. There's a whole series of things, and my mom satisfied every one of them. My mom went on the Dick Cavett show. You remember who Dick Cavett is?
Of course.
Yeah. So she went on the Dick Cavett show.
Forget Dick.
Yeah. She said she was
Rob,
building.
You love Dick, don't you?
Not as much as you.
What are you talking
it's
about?
It's because you haven't watched it enough.
So immature.
He was so one immature. Of those, oh, me, Dick Cavett. That was a Richard joke. I get it now.
Yeah.
But no.
Richard Cavett. Oh, you mean Richard Cavett?
Richard Cavett. Of all the Cavetts, Dick was the best one. But he wasn't Jay Leno. He wasn't Johnny Carson. Johnny Carson was charisma and was, you know, Karnak and all those kind of variety
Dick
show
was kind of chill.
He
reserved.
Was chill. And you would sit down and you'd get like the serious interview with Dick Cavett, like John Lennon sitting down with Dick Cavett, with, you know, like those kind of interviews.
He didn't upstage you. He didn't do anything. He was just kind of there and nice. And
yeah, he was smart. He was a little, he was tough. He was kind of like a tough guy. Like,
really,
you know,
little Dick Cavett?
I always got this sense that he had an edge to him.
So you've hung out with him?
No. I'm just me watching the show. I can't actually watch my mother's this particular episode. It's available on YouTube.
Why?
It's just too painful. She's too mentally unstable and like she's.
So
just,
you have seen or you've heard about
it? I've seen
it.
A little bit of it and I couldn't watch it. I was like, so she tells him she's going to build an ark in the desert.
But is she sort of like...
Like she was Moses.
Calm
like she was
when she's saying this, or she just like... It no, was all she over was, the place.
Well, the thing about my mom was she was really intense. When she would look at you, she would lock on your eyes, and that was it. You were in her tractor beam, and her eyes would like go back and forth between your eyes when she was talking. Wow. And if there was any of these kinds of stakes or issues being talked about, you know, like life thing, when she was saying she was a messiah basically on the show, but she would just, her eyes would go back and forth, really beady, fast eyes looking at you. And you were like, you didn't know if you should look at both of the eyes, like try and keep up with her, or just look at one. And the effect that my mother had on people is
profound,
unbelievable. All over the world I go and people come up to me sobbing, your mother saved my life. But she was clearly just batshit crazy, like in that one. And she, there were other things, like she won 3 or 4 Emmys and an Oscar.
For the Patty Duke show?
I don't think she won for the Patty Duke show. She was nominated for 10, I think. I found out after she died, I like didn't know certain things. But there was one that she won where she was with Desi Arnaz Jr.
Mm-hmm.
They were like Bennifer.
Yes, which people thought that was your father. Right.
Yeah. So that was, you know, she still almost to the end of her life kind of maintained that, even though it clearly wasn't true. But
because you had it tested, your blood tested.
Blood DNA, and DNA, right? And all that. And there's just not a man. No, he's
were you
weak.
Hoping?
Yeah, I definitely was hoping.
You're definitely hoping your dad's.
Yeah. Junior, yeah. And but they were really in love. I mean, whenever they would talk, my mom was married a couple times after him. And he was married to a woman he loved who passed away, Amy. And we're friends now. We're like, he's like my godfather, basically. We sort of settled on that as an idea. They would tell these stories. You could tell that they had this profound connection with each other. But they were dating in one of these kind of tiffs that you'd see on TMZ now or something like that. And she wins the award, and she goes up and she takes the trophy. And I think it was like the shortest
speech
ever. Like, yeah, like the shortest speech ever, where she looks, I can't remember exactly how she says it, but it is horrifying. It's so embarrassing. She looks livid, like she could just throw the Emmy at somebody. They were having some fight.
And she took it on stage with her.
Absolutely. She was fucking
You
got
to know how to turn it off. It's hard to turn it off.
Well, but people, it was interesting. It was explosive. You know, she was a fascinating person to be around. I don't know if there's a good reason for people to, you know, kind of lose control of themselves. But she generally, her sense of injustice was very strong. And I would take her side in an argument most of the time until she got until she got off the radar.
Well, so, you said something about promiscuity. Was she promiscuous?
Oh, yeah. That's a thing. She was also a prude, too, if you can be both.
How could you be both?
If she was.
Maybe Rob here is a prude.
Well, you don't know. Just go rooting through his closets and see what kind of boas he has. Like,
I'll go pruding through his closet.
No, she was just... what used to be called the manic side, the mania associated with bipolar, is just about emotional extremes. And people talk about how she would talk about, and others talk about, having this incredibly heightened sense of awareness about everything around them, their ability to connect with people, the way they experience the natural, you know, just a sunset or something like that. It's too much. It's like what you hear about with drugs and stuff, like but without drugs, and people get, you know, it gets bad. But your original question had to do with like, why am I like basically a nice guy?
That's what I was going to get to. Like, how did you, because you're not talking just Patty Duke, but your father, who your mother remarried, who adopted you.
Yeah. John Astin. Yeah.
It was John Astin, who, by the way,
Gomez.
I had no idea it was Gomez from the original Addams Family, which is, he was unbelievable. He's such an unbelievable talent, and he's still around. He's in 90?
89,
and he's teaching
at Johns Hopkins. He's runs the drama department there. He's been...
It's just incredible. Yeah. You sent me a picture like a couple weeks ago, and I was like, oh my God!
Cool. He moves slow, and he talks slow, but he is, he's just sharp as a tack, and the students love him. He now has 20 years worth of students who've graduated, who come back to the university, who are starting to have successful careers, and you see them interviewed on shows, and they talk about their influences and their training, and they talk about my dad, and
I want to hear how you grew up, how this was, how did you have any normalcy?
Well, in a weird way, by the time I came along, they had already done the fame thing at the highest level, so they were a little over. Like the coolness of it, or being, you know, my dad was married. He had three sons from his – my three older brothers were his first sons from his first marriage. And, you know, when Adam's family blew up, I mean, he was like Jack Nicholson.
Did he get rich from that?
No. Not as much as he should have. Neither of them had the kind of money they should have had based on the success they had. With my mom's case, it's because she spent more than she earned. So, you know, you can earn $1 million, but if you spend $1.2 million, you're $200,000 in debt, you know?
Yeah.
But at one point my dad started a video editing business, and I don't know how much he put into it, maybe like $500,000, $750,000, $1 million, something like that. I don't know. And it was at the time where he was ahead of the curve, and he realized that the studios didn't have the facilities to do all their, you know, like chips and what other ones were out there that I think he might have done Murder, She Wrote and
chips.
Some of those, like, remember Chips?
Yeah.
So they could sub farm out to him and his shop to edit some of the stuff or do the title sequences or whatever. But he was just too ahead of his time. If it took him $1 million to get equipment installed, you know, video equipment that now is on your telephone, it would take a huge room to fill it up.
Oh, yeah.
And by the time they'd get it in, it was obsolete. So he couldn't keep up with the turnover. And anyway, so that really hurt his kind of wealth, I would say, early.
But growing up, how did he deal with your mom? How did your mom deal with you guys? How are you affected? Because as a child, you don't understand. You can't say, you know, when your mother has a personality disorder, you don't understand that as a child, do you?
Well, they didn't understand it. She didn't understand it. My dad didn't. But my dad believed in psychotherapy. He had done a 5-year psychoanalysis.
I'm going to try that.
And he tells amazing stories about what he experienced. It's a long process. But my mom was too impatient to do that kind of thing. But in a way, what I was trying to say about them, like, having already been famous was, like, we lived in a house that from the curb looked like a mansion. It looked like it was up the stairs. It was a big staircase, and you were like, oh, man, that's a mansion. But then you go in, it had a living room and a dining room and a kitchen and then some bedroom. It didn't feel like a mansion. You know, we didn't feel like...
It was
like,
just that when you were looking up, it looked big.
It looked big from
when
you're
in there.
You're in there, it's not that big a deal. The coolest feature
was...
You mean
like my house, right, Rob? I knew you were going to say that. He thinks my house is huge. It's not.
I tell people it's huge.
He does. He wants me to make me feel like, oh, I'm so rich. I'm so...
When you have big ceilings, it feels rich.
Yeah, but it's not that big.
Over there, in your room, you have big ceilings.
Yeah.
It looks, well, when you have a giant guest house in the backyard.
There's no guest house. See what he does? There's dog shit up there.
We had a room, a separate room, kind of like an apartment, but it was one bedroom with a little bathroom and a little closet above the den, what we called the den. And so each of my three older brothers would spend kind of their last years before they moved out up there. And that was the only thing that kind of felt like, oh, you've got a separate...
Right.
Like entrance of the thing. But my point is just that I never really felt like we were well-heeled. Like, their fame, we were aware of it, but it was never... I just never felt like that.
If you were in the middle of it, it might have been different. But the fact that you weren't, and the fact that they were end of it, they were over it in a way.
And their values, like, they were hippie-type people. My dad was kind of a hippie. Not really, he was sort of a conservative hippie, if you can have that. But, like, we went to a public school up in Bellagio Road School was the elementary school. My older brothers went to, I think, Warner or something like that. Like, it was public school. So we were right in with everybody else. And, you know, it just didn't, we played Little League. Little League felt normal. They had an approach to life that was whatever their celebrity was, they could enjoy it internally and, like, where it counted, but they didn't need to demonstrate it. There was no evidence. My mom's Oscar, I think, was like, you know, in the bathroom or something, like, you know, like the doorstop or something. You know, it was the coolest things were, like, my dad would get the 16mm projector out and he'd set up a projector and we would watch episodes of Adam's Family.
That's dope.
That's like, but then you put it away. You know what I mean? Like, if your friends came over, people weren't friends with us because our parents were famous. They couldn't give a shit if our parents were famous. So that's like one important reality to think about if you want to understand my little situation. But the other thing was, my dad was an intellectual. He was an intellectual. He had gone to grad school. You know, he'd gotten his dad was a very, very famous, not famous, but a very influential man. He was head of what they call the Bureau of Standards, which now is the National Institute of Science and Technology. It's basically the regulators of science. So my adopted dad, sadly I don't get any of this genetic inheritance, but he, you know, so he was an intellectual, and his he would, even though it would drive my mother up the wall to hear people talk about it, because she knew the like blood and guts guy that you would interact with. But his lessons to us, his teaching.
How did he teach you? Because I have the, whatever you're going to say, I could say the opposite. So,
well,
like, for example, if my father, for instance, was trying to teach me algebra,
yeah,
my father would say, how do you not know that? No, I'm not even joking. He'd say, I could do this backwards in my head. Why don't you know this?
Ouch.
If X is 4, then what? Are you an idiot? And then my mom drugged out in the other room doing like...
cartwheels?
No, like imaginary, what are those? Snow angels on the carpet. She would be like, Mark, leave him alone. But that's, I remember that.
I think we're getting to the bottom of why you didn't sort of set the goal to be book smart.
Yes, but your parents were the opposite, probably.
Well,
did you get yelled at?
My mother was bipolar. You better believe
it. So did she like hit you?
Yeah, there was physical abuse.
Really?
Yeah. Usually, there's always a reason, but there was, you know, it was, yeah. But my dad was, he would go calm. And it pissed her off, because the more she would freak out, the more he would just get mellower and mellower. But when he would raise us with stuff, he'd say things like, hey, put yourself in the other guy's shoes. And you know, two wrongs don't make a right. And he would say it at critical moments when you'd just gotten beat up in school or something like that. And you were opinionated about stuff. So there was a value system there.
But let me go back, because you said something that you kind of passed over that I think a lot of people would pass. It seems to me like, you know, a lot of people, you know, had a little bit of abuse or a little bit of verbal abuse or a little, you know, they were spanked or whatever. Yeah. You know, my dad, did he beat me up? No. Did he spank me? Yeah. Did he hit me every once in a while? Yeah. He was very young when he had me. He was going through a lot. You know, and I love him, and he's definitely turned a new leaf in my life, and, you know, working hard to, you know, just, he was always a workaholic. But like, you know, when your mom has a mental illness, is that almost like you've forgiven her because you're like, my mother wasn't like every other person with a normal brain. So if she ever got abusive, you know, it wasn't her. Did you go to therapy?
Later in life, but not for that. You know, my wife and I at one point sat down and like had a year of meetings with a therapist and talked about it. It was, oh my God, the biggest thing that I learned is that I talk too much. You know, at a certain point, it was like, you have to shut the fuck up once in a while.
And
you talk too much.
But that's kind of who we are, but you know what? Yeah.
So, and the guy who married my wife and me, when he was doing the little pre-interviews of like, you know, before they marry you, they want to see if they think that this is a good idea for you or whatever. And after he had talked to us.
What are those people called?
Priests.
Well, no, this was a Lutheran minister who had retired from that. So I don't know what had happened with him. Actually, I probably don't want to know what happened with him, but Pastor Newcomb, Bob Newcomb was his name. Like Duke Newcomb?
Duke Newcomb. Yeah. Or Newcomb High?
Newcomb High. Newcomb was this guy. And he, at the, when he talked to us, he said, I think you guys, he said, I'm happy to marry you. I think you guys are going to be great together. He said, but Sean, you need to listen more, because apparently he would ask a question of Christine and I would not like the direction the answer was going, and I would kind of railroad it. So, yeah. So that wasn't good. But
do you think that's a defense mechanism? Do you think you kind
just
of like,
rude? To me, it's just immaturity. Just like, you know,
like you, or is it maybe controlling a little bit in an inadvertent way, sort of like a subtle way, like I don't want that conversation to go down that path. So let's change it. I think I've done that probably with my mom before, because I'm embarrassed and I don't want her to say what I think she's going to say.
Right.
So I'm like, yeah, well, she doesn't. Yeah, that's enough.
We had similar experience with lots of siblings from lots of different parents and remarriages kind of thing. Like I didn't explain it fully with my dad and his three sons, and then me, and then they had my little brother Mackenzie, and then they divorced, and my mom got remarried, and she had, and two stepdaughters came with that. Jesus. And then they adopted and Christine's life was kind of like that too. But to go back to the abuse thing.
Yeah.
We felt sorry for her. You know what I mean? It was like watching a little kid act out. So even though we were little kids, and a lot of times I would kind of adopt the paternal vibe You know, that was an interesting role to assume sometimes when she'd be freaking out about my dad. And in some ways she's looking to the kids to adjudicate the fight. You know, your father did this and your father did that and he did this and that. And then she looks at you and you're now in the position of having to say, like, you're right, Mom. You know what? He shouldn't have done that. Or be like, well, you know, but you did kind of flip out before you had a you know, you're like this weird juror. So what ends up happening is you develop this ability to kind of, you know, run between the raindrops where you don't. But a tone is what she really wants. She wants a nurturing, supportive, understanding tone. You know, and it's impossible with any relationship to kind of like break it all down into its component parts. But this is the quality that people are interested in hearing because it's what's different from or it's what they've experienced that people don't like to talk about. So when my mom was physically abusive, I always sensed that she knew what my limits were and she didn't push past them. So where there was abuse, you were kind of like, it was almost performance art. And you kind of like, well, maybe this doesn't hurt as much as it could. There was one or two times where she lost it, where she wasn't.
I can see your eyes till you remember exactly the moment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 100%. The one thing is we were always loved. It was very clear. There was never any lack of love. They were both very smart people. My dad and his kind of trained Shakespearean, you know, intellectual way. And my mom in her very street smart, my mom was incredible. You know, she became president of the Screen Actors Guild and she wrote a couple of books and she's a very, very powerful woman and an accomplishment. After she died, my stepdad drove down from Idaho with a bunch of her stuff and kind of was like, listen, this is stuff you might want to have. And we were going through these boxes of her awards and accolades and stuff. And
you never knew about her.
Never even thought of
it. And when did she pass?
3 years ago.
How old was she?
69. It's her 69th year.
Pretty young.
Yeah, she smoked like 3 packs a day. She lived hard. Not just, cigarettes were really bad, but, you know, she was always just like, there's so much anxiety and stress and tension, and that can't, you know, that's what kills you.
Did you notice any physiological things caused by the emotional things that she was going through, like that became physical, like tics or things that you noticed that, from the stress and the anxiety and the...
Well, she was sort of tough the way she smoked. She'd like hold a cigarette between her teeth like a longshoreman. You know what I mean? And you just got this sense like she would terrify grown men. When she was president of the Screen Actors Guild, you know, the Teamsters were behind her. She helped them broker away what was going to be a strike. And she got there and stood up for the Teamsters.
Wow.
And they loved her. She could literally snap her fingers and there could be 1,000 Teamsters behind her, you know, supporting her in whatever she wanted to do for the rest of her life. I mean, she was beloved by them. But, you know, you'd see her get in somebody's face and it's like a little dog that doesn't know its height or its size. You know, they'll just go against the Rottweiler because as far as they're concerned, if the fight's there, they're in the fight. And my mom was like that. And she would scare people. And she had a whistle. She had a whistle that was like, I don't know what, like she could hail cabs from blocks away. And I never figured out, you know, with her pinkies against her tongue, I could never do that.
My friend Tom Lally could do that. Yeah. I can't do that.
But her, in terms of her like mannerisms and stuff, I mean, the medicine that she took, and not just bipolar medicine, but she had bypass surgery a few times, stents. She had a lot of stents put into her heart. She was like Job in the last 10 years of her life, just always some new thing. And yet she would always kind of get herself put together to do an interview or to do to go do a show, an episode of a show that she would do. But she looked pretty frail. But she had a kind of tremors. They call them tremors. So I'm not sure.
That started probably in the 60s when she was in her 60s.
The tremors were later in her life and they became more and more noticeable.
I meant in her 60s.
In her 60s. I think I meant in the 60s.
Yeah, probably. And so, like, out of all of this, like, you think in a way, like most kids, when their parents are actors or, you know, have a lot of fame, some just go the opposite way. Like, I don't want, you know, their parents don't want them to do it. I'm sure your parents were very open to whatever you want to do, and you just kind of, how did you get in a...
Well, they helped. My mother...
Because you were young when you started.
So my mother had suffered all kinds of abuse as a kid, even though she was really fit. She did The Miracle Worker when she did on Broadway for a year, I think when she was 13 or 14, and then they did the movie when she was 14 or 15. I think she won the Oscar for it when she was 15. At that point, I think she was the youngest person to win an Oscar. But she had these managers. The Rosses were her managers, and they were these people who, they kind of had the industry wired in New York, and they would meet all these kids, and then they would, you know, they pick the ones that they thought had a chance, and then they'd send them out for auditions, and if they got the parts, they were their managers. But it was almost like they were caretakers, and when my mom hit, it was like she was the golden goose. But he was sexually abusive to her. But I think when it came to me, after she had been like, America loved her. She was the Patty and Kathy from the Patty Duke Show, and she was this sweet, kind of virginal, beautiful, funny thing. And then when she, when Desi Arnaz and I became friends in my mid 20s, and I came to his house was just down the street from here. And he opened the closet door for me, and there was a stack of like 30 magazines that his mother had saved for him, that Lucille Ball saved for him, where he was on the cover page, you know, like it was him and my mom. He had a relationship with, before my mom, with Judy Garland's daughter, with
Liza Minnelli.
With Liza. And so there was a little bit of that, but most of it was the kind of, you know, turbulent Ben and Jennifer. You know what I mean? Like they were the it people who were having drama, and her mom wanted to save that for him. So he gave those to me, and I went through and read them. And my mother was cast by the people writing those things as this sort of, you know, wrong side of the tracks. You know, she was the older woman who was, you know, defiling the heir to the prince of television, you know, Desi Arnaz Jr., whose name was born. It wasn't actually Desi, but you know, when he was born, it was on the cover of Life magazine or whatever, a television guide. And it was, you know, all of America knew that Lucy and Desi had this boy, Desi. And so it was really hard for her to be the like villain in the scenario, because that's the way they wrote about her, you know, and she was crazy. She was smoking. He was a few years younger, and they just made her. She ended up doing, what was the movie she played? Neely O'Hara in Valley of the Dolls.
Valley of the Dolls.
She was in Valley of the Dolls, where she played a drinking drug addict kind of gnarly character. And it was like that stuck. And she had gotten married to the AD on her show and gotten divorced. So very quickly, by like 24 years old, she was this like spent, you know, and she had lived 15 lives in one life. So when I came along and you know, when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, I think she wanted to have like the perfect kid. She wanted to prove to everyone that she was like the perfect mother, and that you didn't have to have the kind of turmoil that she had in her life in order to have success. So when I was 7 or 8, I always get the dates a little bit wrong, or the ages a little bit wrong, but I was 7 or 8, and she came to me and said, they're doing an after school special. You remember these after school specials?
Yeah.
They would do these like issue of the week shows, child abuse, teen pregnancy, drug addiction.
Kind of groundbreaking.
It was groundbreaking, but it was also lame because they would just wrap it all up in a nice, neat little bow in 20 minutes, you know? Yeah.
But they would still talk about it at least.
Yeah. So they wanted my mom to play this abusive mother. And she said, okay, but if my son can be the abused child.
That's right. That's right.
So I played.
Jesus.
It was called Please Don't Hit Me, Mom. And
Please Don't Hit Me, Mom. Starring your mother as your mother and you as you.
I actually just saw the poster for it. Lance Guest was in it. I don't know if you ever knew who Lance Guest was. And Nancy McKeon of, what do you call it, Facts of Life fame that my brother started for 5 years. So it was their three names, my mom and those two. And then my name wasn't mentioned on the poster at all. But the poster was of my mom crying on a couch, hugging me. And I had like, I just remember I had this like really big hair. But it was an interesting experience.
She in the movie or in the she was the abusive. Show. She was abusive.
Yeah.
So you were like reliving your life. I mean, your life essentially. You were playing a part where it's like, this is real.
Yeah.
This is actually happening in my house. But you didn't say that. No one there on set.
No one had.
No
to
one
say
in
anything.
The world knew anything. That you think they just knew? You think people knew what that your mom?
I think you could tell. I think you could tell. I mean, she was the nicest person in the world. Not quite Henry Winkler, but actually some people probably say nicer than Henry Winkler. But she was an intense person too. She laughed. People loved her. She was friends with
on
people.
On the set? Did they like her?
Everywhere. Everyone loved my mom.
Were you thinking, do they think my mother's really like this? Or were you embarrassed? Were you like thinking, I mean, how did you deal? To me, I would have been like, I don't know.
Well,
you
deal with
different things as a kid and they come out later in life.
When I say I was abused, there were a few terrible episodes.
Right, but it wasn't every day.
I wouldn't even change my childhood now if I could go back. I'd maybe change those few episodes, but we lived a very empowered life.
Right.
I mean, it was a time when you could ride your bicycle, you know, and when I was 5 through 14, you could go anywhere. You could do anything. Friends could come over in the middle of the night. You know, like you
me
just
too.
Yeah,
climb over
hedges,
fences,
and, yeah.
To go in other people's backyards,
yeah,
and play wiffle ball when they weren't there, and walk down. Yeah,
get on your bike and go into town and be gone for 14 hours
people,
and then come back. And
no one ever says a word
as long as you're there when they put food on the table.
Yes, like, and no one can understand that. I feel bad for people who didn't get to experience that sort of simple life where there wasn't phones everywhere and there wasn't, because that kind of world, that it was just kind of a fantasy, wasn't it? If you think back.
Yeah. And I think a lot of kids around the world today still do experience that. I think once people have resources is when they start to insulate themselves a little bit or kind of control the people that they interact with or where you go or how long you're gone and, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And all over the country, there's places where people live like that still. So, but for me, we were empowered. And when my mom said she wanted to do this, we would get in the car like at 4:30 in the morning, because her call time was earlier than mine, because she's a woman and women go through the makeup process longer. So it was fun.
Right.
It was fun. It was like, I'm going to work. First of all, what I said when she says, do I want to do it? I said, well, am I going to miss school? Oh, no. My first thing was, do I get paid? That was my first question. 8 years old.
She's like, yes.
Yeah. She goes, you get $10,000, but you don't actually get the money until you're 18. It goes in an account, which she was actually instrumental in helping create the law, the Coogan law, that made it so that parents and managers and agents can't take all the money. They can only take a certain amount of it. So she was, and she, her thing was, I'll never touch a nickel of your money. I was like, well, you know, parents actually do kind of give up a lot when their kids are working. So you can see why a certain amount of the money would be.
That $10,000 was probably, if she kept it in that Coogan account.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever got it.
What?
I must have gotten it. I just don't know. I was like, I mean, I'm sure I did. But, I mean, she wouldn't have touched it. That was a point of pride for her. But when I was doing the Goonies, for example, my parents couldn't come with me to the set. It was like, you know, 6 months of work, and they had their own jobs and their own lives. And
did you have fun? Did you miss them? Were you scared?
No, was not scared. No, it was awesome. It was awesome. It was a great experience. It was like I said, my childhood was a great childhood. There was so much fun and love and joy and everything else. But the thing that that people key on are the kind of most intense, traumatic moments. So,
Look, nobody has a perfect life. And you've had a great life. So, yeah, if you had a couple of moments, or your mother wasn't perfect because she was, you know, she had bipolar and she was suffering from that. And she had a couple of episodes.
You know what annoyed me the most?
That doesn't make her a bad person. It doesn't.
You know what annoyed me the most was when she got diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And she was, so she accepted the diagnosis. That's a big key. You know, it takes a lot less time now to get an accurate diagnosis than it did then. Then it was like 8 years. 8 years for people suffering to get an accurate diagnosis, and then however long it took to get a wellness plan with medicine that actually worked right for you and stuff like that. So, but then she became the expert. She wasn't actually an expert, but she acted like an expert, and she was always diagnosing everybody everywhere she
but
went.
But how brave, though.
No, it was very brave. It was very brave, but it was annoying because she would present to the world that she was, you know, that she'd had this. She loved the diagnosis because it gave her kind of a reason to explain away, not explain away, but
her behavior.
And so what she did was she took back the power from people who would have judged her for that.
You're crazy. You're this.
We don't want to work with her because, you know, she's unstable. you know, your career, the people in show business, your reputation is like everywhere. It's everything. And if you're known as somebody who doesn't show up on time, or you have fits or walk off the set or argue with the director or whatever, nobody wants to hire you. So, but she was able to flip that and become someone who everyone wanted to work with, because look at how strong she was, and look at her courage, and look at her determination. But when you're in her house and you close the door and she would still freak out because like her food order was wrong or something, you'd be like, where's the, you know, the maven of, you know, mental health, you know, at this moment? So it was an amazing learning experience, not just the fight scenes where she'd be, you know, the abuse scenes, which were, I was a little bit nervous, uncomfortable laughter. That's my first acting story that I tell people, is that, you know, she's supposed to grab me. I like forgot to tell her something, or I dropped a math book, or I don't know what it was in the show. And so she's grabbing me in the kitchen and banging me against the cupboard. And so I'm laughing, and the director's getting nervous. You know, these TV movies, they don't have a lot of time to sort of think about stuff. You got to
use it because it's interesting.
Well,
interesting choice, Sean.
They were just panicked because I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. So my mom took me outside and she goes, "Sean, this is my career. I took a chance on you. Right?" And I start to cry. And she's like, "Okay." And they go, and she's like, rolling. So they roll, and she's beating me up, and I'm crying and everything. And then they say, cut. And the director's like, "God, that was amazing." And my mom hugs me, and tears are rolling down my cheeks because I've just like disappointed or whatever. And she looks at me and she smiles and she goes, "Honey, that's acting. You did it." And you're like, oh, good. Okay, good. That's like a good thing, I guess.
Oh,
so,
man.
But she taught me practical things like, you know, this is where your mark is. You have to hit your mark. You have to know your dialogue. Be aware of your light. Be better off camera than on camera. Like a whole series of really practical, useful things.
You have
things.
To be better on camera, off camera than on camera.
That was her thing as a professional.
That's always true. You know, and to explain that, it's like, you know, when you're doing your scene with somebody, when it's your close-up, a lot of actors will do their best work. But the best work really needs to be for your partner, your scene partner, so they can get their best work from you. So you
that's
know,
what a professionals
do. Yeah. And I've dealt with, I'm sure I've been, you know, there's been moments where I'm exhausted after a 15-hour day and I'm not as peppy as, right. I'm not as intense. My voice is gone. I've been yelling all day.
Yeah.
And the other actor's like, "Hey, you don't have to yell. I've heard you yell all day. You could," you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was a famous scene in On the Waterfront where Rod Steiger,
who
played his brother for that major big scene at the very end.
Somebody.
He wasn't there.
He wasn't there.
Brando didn't want to be there for his close-up for that.
Right.
So Steiger used to always fuck with him if he'd see him. "You fucking bastard. You aren't there," you know.
Yeah, but it turned out good.
It turned out well. But Steiger would all tell that story. I did this little movie.
But my mom, you know, there's if you pull at the thread of it, there's a lot of trust that happens between actors. You know, you can be embarrassed. You can hurt each other, even inadvertently, if you're not thoughtful about what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
Not physically, but... But, you know, acting is it's I mean, not if you're just in a program or thing, but there are moments where certain scenes are very tender. And if you've had to be patient waiting to get a part, and then you have to be patient to shoot your part, and then you get your one little moment and somebody just kind of doesn't appreciate it, it hurts, you know. And so my mom's thing, she was always about justice. And that kind of thing is like, you want to be there for the other actor because that you it's a moral obligation that you have to that person. And when in school, she'd be like that too. You know, you want to make sure that every kid feels included and respected. And, you know, God forbid if she was watching a Little League game, if a coach, an opposing coach or some kid did the wrong thing, oh my God.
She'd lose it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, she'd want to see that.
Yeah. And they would apologize very quickly with my mother.
Oh,
she's
yes.
Terrifying.
Now, let me ask you this. So, you know, we've talked about, and thank you for being so open about this. You know,
I always talk about this stuff.
You do?
Yeah.
You always talk about
it. Always
do. In the media?
Everywhere.
You don't care?
No.
Because you know why? Because it sounds like, because that's what your mother did.
Because that's how I was raised. But just, so with her practical thing, and then my father, like my father insisted we always have the same academic experience that our contemporaries were. So if I was acting in a show, I had to be able to walk off the set, go to the school, sit down and take the same test as everybody else and do well. That was his determination. So you can just see, I'm describing parents that love us, a mother that wanted to instill a sense of professionalism, a father who believed in academics, and it would have been very hard to produce a kid in that environment who wasn't kind of like, you know, nice, because that was what was expected.
That's pretty extraordinary. God, I can talk about this forever, honestly. How would you describe, like, if you had to say in a couple of words, Spielberg, working with Spielberg?
He's a quiet giant.
A quiet giant.
Yeah.
Doesn't say much.
Well, I mean,
when he
says something, it's always like, wow, that makes sense. Like his, you know, my wife would call one of the big brain people.
What did he do before Goonies besides Jaws?
Well, he did.
Trying to think of what he did.
Amblin was his short film. I think Wasserman gave him a shot on Duel.
Right.
Duel was that trucking.
Was Indiana Jones around then? Before that? Was that after?
After.
So
No. Yes, of course it was. Because,
yeah, it was before.
Because Short Round, who was in the second one.
Was, right.
Kiwi Kwan, who you've
right,
met.
Temple
I think,
of Doom.
Yeah, Temple of Doom. He was, Steven gave him a part in The Goonies playing Data.
Right.
So, yeah. So, yes, no, it had definitely been done. I remember walking in for the audition and looking up, and there was a poster. I think it was R2-D2 putting a crown on E.T.'s head. That was the, and it was George, it was the story, I mean, George Lucas, who had done
Indiana Jones.
Star Wars.
And Star Wars.
Which was the biggest box office, whatever.
He produced
whatever.
Indiana Jones.
Right.
Right? Did he write it?
Whatever. I don't think he wrote it. No. I don't think he wrote it.
No, that was Kurtz, what's the guy who wrote Empire Strikes Back? He's the one who wrote, I think, somebody's going to
really?
Kill me out there.
I know.
My brain's dead. But anyway.
It's early here in California, folks.
Yeah.
It's
Lawrence Kasdan?
Lawrence Kasdan,
yeah. Right?
Who wrote Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. And Raiders, right?
And Grand Canyon. Does that buy me back into the conversation?
Is that right?
Danny Glover, yeah. Actually, my buddy Marco Black and I wrote Revenge of the Jedi, a script that we wanted to shoot with our Super 8.
Well, that's what it was originally called.
Right.
Revenge of the Jedi, before they called it. Was that right?
You're right.
Yeah, thanks.
And I did a miniseries with Elizabeth Montgomery and Elliot Gould. I played their son. And the set teacher was friends with Lawrence Kasdan. So when she saw that my friend and I had written, mostly my friend wrote it, this, and my brother tries to steal this story like it was his thing, but I did this. So we sent it to him, and he sent us back these Empire Strikes Back books and this wonderful letter, like congratulating us on how cool the script was and hope we did real well with our film and his film. Empire Strikes Back was coming out. Like,
do you still have a letter? No.
No.
So let me ask you. So when you went in the audition room,
yeah,
Steven's there.
So my father and I worked on the audition. This is what I'm saying. Like when I had the audition.
What was the scene?
It was a scene that's not in the movie now. It was a scene where Mikey is, I don't know who he's talking to, but he says, he's talking about when his dad went to Hollywood to be on The Price is Right. And he was given an option between door number one, door number two, and door number three. And I describe what the possibilities were. And he chose door number two or whatever and opened it up, and it was a jar of toothpicks. And it was like, and he saw how much it hurt his father. And he was like, I never want to have that in my life. I never want to, like, I want to make my own destiny sort of thing.
Right.
So really cool, sophisticated scene.
Never shot it.
Never made it. But my dad at his condo, they were separated now, divorced now. And my dad worked with me for a long time on the audition. And he kept saying things to me like, Sean, don't act. Don't do what you think your idea of acting is. He says, just when I'm talking, just listen. Listen to what I'm saying. And when you're talking, just say it. This kid is you. And nothing that's being said is out of your own experience. So, you know, like it's nothing basically like that you can't understand. So we work on this. Then we drive over. That was in West LA. We drive over to Universal on the back lot is the Amblin lot.
Yep.
And we pull in there. My dad had this Mercedes that after they were divorced, my mom gave him as this like total gaslighting thing to like give him. It was weird. And he hated Mercedes, and he was like, but anyhow. And it was diesel. So you could just hear it.
Like out in the Astons.
Right. So I go in and I'm in there, and it's Amblin was this kind of Spanish motif architecture that he did that kind of would become known for, very similar to a lot of the Indiana Jones kind of Marrakesh, you know, Morocco style looking thing, and just really cool. And it was on the lot. the guy was so successful, he had a whole complex on the lot. So so I was in there waiting. And
you got nervous?
I was terrified.
You really were?
Absolutely terrified.
It's the biggest director in Hollywood.
And you're on the lot, and you know, you drive onto a lot, and there's an audition. It's the same thing for me when I travel. Like, I've been in London, I have to fly to New York, or in LA and fly to New York, or somewhere to fly to. When you have to fly somewhere for an audition or a meeting,
it's a lot.
I never get it. No. I never get it. I always walk in, and I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know. I'm nervous.
So what did your dad say to you? Was he like, just calm down, breathe?
I don't know that I was showing him how nervous I was. We worked on it, and it was good.
You knew it.
I knew it, and so I go in there, and I'm standing there waiting, and the lady, you know, and it's also kind of cool. It's kind of cool. Like, I have a right to be here. I have an audition.
Other kids around you too?
No, it was late. It was like 5 o'clock, 5:30.
So you're the only kid in there.
I was the only guy.
That's probably good. You probably would have been maybe intimidated by another kid.
I think they wanted me before I even got there. I had met with a casting director.
You think they wanted you as the lead before you even got the part?
I think they knew enough about me
somehow.
Did
Steven ever tell you that later?
No, they wouldn't. They probably wouldn't say that.
All right, so go in the room.
Then a guy named Mark Marshall, who's been a lifelong friend ever since, comes up, and he was Steven's personal assistant. And he says, "Hi, we're going to come in now." And I was like, "Great." So we go walking down, and there's just no overstating how cool the Spanish tile floor was, and the curved Spanish curved doorways, and the big posters of Raiders and whatever else was on the wall, and E.T. And yet it was like, it was so, I don't know, I had never seen anything, like, I wanted to live there.
It was comfortable.
It was
warm.
It was warm, and it's like, oh, this is how rich people that are really cool, like, decorate.
Right.
This is how cool rich people decorate. So we're walking through, and he says, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "Well, yeah, a little bit." He goes, "Why?" I said, "I don't know." He goes, "Well, you're just about to meet the most powerful man in Hollywood." And he opens the door. And he had this smile on his face. And I was like, okay. So I go in there, and there's a big table set up, like, you know, wide table. I don't know how you'd have, like, a meal at this table, because if you're like, "Could you pass the salt?" you'd have to stand up and reach way over. It was like a big table, like intimidating distance between you and the people on the other end of the table. Harvey Bernhardt, Richard Donner, who directed it, Dick Donner, who directed Superman and The Omen and Lady Hawk and all the Lethal Weapon movies, and, you know, Dick Donner. So he's there, and Steven's there. So they said, "Well, can you just introduce yourself?" And there's actually footage of this that exists. I don't know if you can pull it up on YouTube or not, but I basically say my name like 58 times. "Hey, my name is Sean Astin, and I'm here to read for Mikey. So my name is Sean Astin." And I, like, I just, in the, like, a nervous tick, just keep saying my name over and over again. And they're just sitting there watching. And
aware that you're saying your name so many times?
No, I'm kind of like, nobody's told me what this is about. I didn't know what doing a slate was.
Right.
They've had me say this, and I was basically trying to work through in my mind, well, what would they want me to, like, how would they want me to say it, or what's the right way to say it? And, you know, and it was kind of funny. It was kind of like a little awkward.
They were charmed by you. You're cute.
They were charmed by me, and I was, like, awkward and nervous. So we do the scene, and it's really good until we get to this one point in it, and I forget the line, and I start shaking. And they're like, "It's all right. You want to pick it up? You want to take it over?" And I was like, "Yeah, can I just look at it?" And I looked at it. I was like, "Oh, right. I remember what it was." So we do it again. And I at the same spot, I've now psyched myself up. At the same spot, I forget. I go, "Shit." And Steven gets up and walks out of the room. And I'm like, well, I guess I'm never going to make, you know,
another
movie in Hollywood. I'm a guy who's cursed. You probably don't want the star of your kid movie to be like a kid who says shit. So Dick Donner gets up, and he comes around, and he takes a knee, and he's looking at me. And I've had this experience so many times with directors and important people in my life and experience, when you can tell they're thinking, what is the thing I can say to get through to this guy? I really want to communicate to it. And I'm almost like, I get it. You're here. I'm here. I know you're going to try and say, go ahead. I'll listen. You know, I don't know what, I mean, I had an experience on Rudy like this. So he just basically tells me the same kinds of stuff my father had been telling me. Don't think about anything. Don't worry about anything. I know you can do this. We really, you know, let's just do it again and blah, blah, blah. So we do it again, and I get to the spot, and I kind of bump on it, but I glance, and I kind of do it. I get through it, but it was like I never did it clean.
Right.
And they said, okay, thank you very much. And I went out, and I got in the car, and my dad goes, how'd it go? I was like, I didn't get it. He goes, what do you mean? It's like, I didn't get it. I kept messing up. I couldn't remember my lines. He goes, that's impossible. He goes, I've never seen someone more prepared for an audition and more right for a part. There's no way you messed it up. I go, Dad, I don't know what to tell you. At this spot, I messed up. I said, oh, shit. He goes, you said shit? I was like, yeah. He's like, I can't believe it. So we drive home. I guess we get home at like 7:30 or 8 at night. It's dark out. And I go in. And there's another movie that was a big movie that was casting, a Joe Dante movie called The Explorers.
Yeah, remember
The Explorers?
That.
Yeah. Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix and was Will Wheaton in that one? No. I was like, I guess we could just start working on that show. And it was funny because we would go 11 months out of the year and not think about an audition. But all of a sudden there were these two that were like really important. I don't remember going on a lot of auditions I didn't get in a weird way. I think the agent knew like – you know, I went into rooms that had been prepared.
Right.
You know, so walked into the house. My mom said, they just called. They offered you the part. And my dad said, I knew you couldn't have messed it up. It was so good. So then the question was, okay, so they've offered you the part and it was like 50 grand or 70 grand or something for 6 months or 4 months that would become, I don't know, whatever it was become. So, but the Explorers, which the Goonies was this fun kids picture, fun pirate adventure that I liked because I got to kiss the girl.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I was fired
the
up.
The older girl.
Oh, the older girl. I was fired up about that. Like, I really wanted to do that.
Did you ever see it, Rob?
Yeah, I've seen Goonies.
Okay,
a lot.
Well,
you know,
you were born after it was released.
What year were you born?
88.
Yep. 83.
85. Yeah. Punk. So,
they were going to offer you more money for the Explorers?
No. I didn't get the offer for the Explorers. I got a test offer. So I could go. And the deal was they negotiate your whole deal and then you sign a piece of paper. All two or three of you who are auditioning sign it. And then they watch you
If you get it,
you're in. So they said you have to choose between the offer.
It's Spielberg. So be an easy
Spielberg offer with where I get to kiss the girl and a movie where I don't get to kiss a girl that if I don't get it, I lose everything. So, but my dad and the agent were like, Sean, this movie is an important movie. It was about these kids who build a spaceship in their backyard and they go into outer space. But it was the way it was written.
It didn't do well.
No, it was terrible. I don't know if the movie was terrible, but it did not do well. I actually remember liking it until they got into outer space, and then I thought it kind of went weird. But
right.
But it was the stakes were very high, emotional stakes for these kids in their lives. And that was a time when they would make movies like that. Like Stand By Me came not too long afterwards. And
sure.
So and they were like, we really think you should do the Explorers test because we think you'll get it and we think that's a thing. And I was like, yeah, I was like, no way. I was like, I want to do that one.
Oh my God. Your career would have gone in a completely, I don't know. You were so good that you would have,
I don't know. I mean, I think.
Did you know you were good?
I don't think I was good the way that River Phoenix was good. I don't think I was good the way Ethan Hawke was good. I don't know if they had more dramatic training or they had more experience because this is what they were really focused on in their life, where with me it was kind of a lark.
Right.
But when I saw some of their performances, I would kind of think, I don't think I could do that. Like, I don't think I know
how. There's always those guys, though. There's always guys I look at and go, I can't.
But I think
that.
I was appealing looking and I was comfortable in front of the camera. Charming.
Cute,
that's like,
and you were good.
Yeah, it wasn't until I was 18 where I was like, that probably won't be enough like if you want to actually make a career out of this.
Right. What was the gap between I mean, Goonies, you kept working. The next big break was Rudy, right?
No, I did when I was 8, I did 2 weeks on Please Don't Hit Me, Mom. When I was 10, I did 4 months on, it was called The Rules of Marriage, that miniseries I mentioned.
Right. After Goonies.
When I was 12 and 13, I did Goonies for 4 to 5 months, something like that. Then I think when I was 14, I did a movie with Kevin Bacon. And then when I was 16, I did a movie called Staying Together. And then when I was 18, I did Memphis Belle.
Yeah, do you ever remember Spielberg ever in 4 or 5 months? Because he was on set, right?
A lot. He didn't direct the movie, but he would redirect scenes if he didn't like what he saw.
Did you ever see him lose his cool?
No, that's what I'm saying. He was a quiet giant.
Never once.
No, and the crew, the way you can tell about a powerful person like that, the people around them behave differently. First of all, the craft service was like the Four Seasons Mother's Day brunch. I mean, when on Stephen's sets, you know, they would roll out this huge thing. The crews were quiet and lightning fast. And if he raised his finger a little bit, 50 eyes were on him to make sure that whatever it was that he instructed, he got it right away. And so everybody was kind of his orchestra.
Did he like you? Did he like talk to you a lot?
I can't remember.
Or did he just like was professional and nice to you, but he didn't go out of his way to go, "Hey, Sean, how you doing? Want to hang out at my house?"
No, he was sort of impish. He was sort of impish, you know, like this movie. I don't know how many movies he had produced that he didn't direct.
This is probably a rarity.
It was early days for him.
I think Poltergeist was probably around that time, right before.
But he
ended up supposedly, God rest Tobe Hooper, who I love, who directed Funhouse and Poltergeist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But a lot of people say that, you know, Spielberg really directed Poltergeist. There's a lot of like, you know, I don't know if it's folklore or whatever, that he was always on set and he was always. So, yes, I think
Dick directed Goonies 80-20. I think he came back and redirected 20%. Maybe 75-25.
Well, he was an established director too. And I think Tobe had just done like Texas Chainsaw, this raw.
Well, they also really amazing, they had sensibilities that really complemented each other.
Yeah.
Dick understood the, like, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea type, you know, adventure, swashbuckling kind of things. And Steven would build little moments that were like really powerful. We did one scene is the wishing well scene. Do you remember the wishing well scene?
Yeah. So this one's for me.
No, there's that wishing well. That's what Corey Feldman says in the beginning when he's like, dreams. Yeah.
One's mine, right?
But then they're going to leave. They're going to go up the bucket with Troy. And I give them this speech, you know, don't you guys see? Don't you realize?
Yeah.
The next time you see Sky, it'll be over another town. The next time you know, Chester Copperpot, he was a pro, but he didn't come this far. And
wait a minute. Do you remember the whole speech?
I'm just hitting it.
Do you remember the whole thing?
I just did the best I could. I can't remember. I could probably assemble it if I was on a desert island and you gave me an hour.
I want you to make your voice 12 years old.
Don't you guys see? Don't you realize? Chester Copperpot, he was a pro and he never got this far.
That's amazing.
thanks to all my voiceover work. But the way they staged it, Dick Donner staged it with me up on top of that little kind of ledge where the bucket was, and then talking down to them, like, don't you guys see? And looking down and making an appeal down to them. And Steven redirected it. Like, he reshot it. He staged me down in the well, just the opposite. And your audience can't see us, but if you're following along, put both your hands out and reach them towards the floor and say, please help me.
You seem powerful and condescending.
Right? Now, reach your hands up to the sky and say, please help me.
It's like a prayer.
It's much more vulnerable.
Oh,
and so Steven did that, you know. But Dick Donner directed the moment with Willie at the end where Mikey has a conversation with Willie. And that was a very soft
where he leaves
moment.
Willie, he goes, this is for you.
Yeah.
Or like being, the rest is for,
I got here, I beat you. That whole thing, yeah. So, and that was very important to Dick, that the emotional tone of that be right. And he talked to me a lot about that. There were some other really great, like, acting cool things. The scene in the attic where the map scene, when he tells them where he tells them the history of the big battle between the ships and the Spanish, you know, the Spanish Armada and Willie, you know, he escaped with the ship, the Inferno, and what did that whole speech. Apparently that had been written for the Fratelli brothers. For one of the Fratelli brothers. Apparently it wasn't as magical coming out of the villain's mouth. So they were in that attic setting. We shoot it. So Dick Donner took me outside. And again, it was when you're a kid, you remember certain things, like getting up early with my mom before it was light, or remembering that it's the end of the day. It's like past dusk, and the kids have to, they're going to cut us loose, you know, that we have certain hours they have to meet and they need to get the day. So he goes, Sean, I'm going to tell you a story. He goes, I just want you to listen. Don't talk. Open your eyes, open your ears, and just hear this whole story. And when I'm finished, I want you to tell it back to me. I said, okay. So he told me the whole Spanish Armada story.
No way. And then you just repeated the story that he told.
And then he said, now tell it to me. And I told him back. He goes,
on film?
Yeah. Well,
oh, that was outside first.
That was outside first. And when I did it, when I said it back to him, he goes, you think you can go in there and do that? And I said, yeah. He goes, great. So we go in there and we sit down and we did it. And
Because it looks like you're actually thinking, it's such good acting. It looks like you're coming up with this stuff that you don't remember. But like, and then there was this, and then there was that, and then there was, and you're like, oh, that's really good acting.
Yeah.
And it's because you really.
Trying to remember.
But it wasn't written. It was just remembering the story. And that's really, that's incredible.
Isn't that cool?
That's really incredible.
Yeah. But Steven, you know, the kissing scene, he wanted to direct.
Was that your first kiss?
Probably not. No, I don't think it was.
Andrea
Canetti was my first kiss.
Was it a tongue?
What? No, it was a very sweet.
Yeah, it was
kiss.
Sweet. I remember it being sweet, so it wasn't like it was a dirty.
Yeah, the big bummer was when I read the script, there was a thing at the end where they kiss again, where she kisses Brand, played by Thanos now, right? By
what's his name?
Josh Brolin.
Brolin.
And so I thought when I read the script, because I kind of read it quickly, and I was young and not a great
reader.
certainly not of screenplays either, anyway, but that she had won him over. He had won her over. So at the end, they get to have a kiss. And somewhere in the 6 months of shooting, I realized that, no, it was an accident that she kissed me, and she really gets to kiss him. So I was not happy when I came to that realization.
Bastards. Why is he so grumpy today? Sean looks like a real dick today.
If I would have known that you could like make a pitch to a filmmaker, like, listen, I think the girl decides she doesn't like the guy that's age appropriate. What if, and just go with me here, what if she falls for the little guy?
Yeah,
that's totally believable.
Yeah, that's exactly what should happen. Look, we talked about like your private life, your growing up, and just I want to talk to you forever. Like, I want to do a two-part.
Let's be friends forever.
Well, we have another guest after this, but would you come back?
Yeah.
Because I didn't even get into Lord of the Rings. I don't ever really talk about that stuff. It's mostly about real stuff.
Uh-huh.
But like, these stories are so great and they're so, like, you've been in movies that are so huge. Even we're on the second season of Stranger Things. You've got a new Netflix series. What's that called?
No Good Nick.
No Good Nick. I mean, you're constantly working. You're such a likable dude. You've done so much and you consistently work. I think you work when you want to, don't you?
I never felt like that until just after Stranger Things. So I was in my...
Are you getting a lot of offers now?
Well, no, I don't get a lot of offers, but now I'm really a known enough quantity. And, you know, you're talking about how I'm a chameleon or whatever. I think in the last 5 years, I've kind of like... And it's bumming me out because after marathons and triathlons and everything, when I was so... Well, yeah, I'm the dad. I'm dad on a kid show. That's what
you're a father figure or parent figure in Stranger Things.
Yeah,
too.
And they kill me off on that. So then Netflix puts me as a
great
dad on another kid.
I didn't see the rest
kid.
Of it yet. You son of a bitch. You ruined it! Do you do Friends projects? Do you do, if you like a script, you'll do it?
Yeah, I'll do anything. I mean...
You'll do anything that you like.
Well, here's the thing. There are certain things that are right to do. When a young actor walks into a room and there's an older performer in the room, if it's, you know, appropriate, if you're not interrupting anything, you go up and you say hello and you just say, thank you so much for your life of work. You know what I mean? You just, there's respect, kind of like, you know, you shook Sinatra's hand. There's a way to be. When you're an older performer, if there's a younger performer there, if there's some way to give them an assist, help them out, give them a thought, you do that because that's like that's what the moment calls for. There are a lot of people who, you know, kids, students, whatever, if they have a film, like, it feels like the right thing in the history of the industry, in that they're
give them a break.
Yeah, like, and it's good for you too. It may just be a student film, but
might be the next Spielberg.
Yeah, but I mean, whatever the moment is that kid's trying to come up with, if you can honor that moment, right, and you create something special, you've done something just as real in that moment as you would do in Lord of the Rings. It's you honor that moment. So it's harder now, I think. My time seems to somehow just
you got a family.
Going so fast, and there's always so much stuff to do. But on there's no standing on ceremony. I remember my dad, I would do all these little short films, you know, Super 8 films. And we did a thing called The Enchanted Dreamer. And it was basically kind of a crib from Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. My little brother was the star of it. And he goes into the cupboard or into the closet in his room. There's like light emanating from it and dry ice. And he goes in there and then he falls through a stitch in time and he's in the woods. So I go to my dad. I created this character called the Alpha and the Omega. The beginning and the end. And I was like, Dad, I want you to come and play this kind of wizard Ben Kenobi guy. And my dad looks at me and he goes, well, you know, Sean, I am a professional actor. You know? And it was so funny. Like, I think he was being serious. I think he was like, you know, like, I need to call his agent. I don't know what. Like, Dad, I'm your son. You should just do what I need you to do to help me. And sure enough, he put on this robe and we went into UCLA woods around UCLA and we filmed this scene and he was wonderful at it. I got my mom to play the queen. So I did have access to talent as a kid.
I like that. Yes, you had a lot of talent. This has been too great. I really don't want to let you go because I know you have no time.
I explained to my kids why I came here this morning.
Why?
They're getting ready for school.
What'd you explain?
Well, I said, you guys know where I'm going? Because I always just leave. They're like, okay, bye, Dad. And I don't have, they have no idea what I do. No idea. You know, they know if it's, you know, Stranger Things. You know, they know
that's cool.
Yeah. And then you do other stuff. And like, Dad, why are you doing that? So I met this guy, Michael. We go to conventions together. And we had a kind of sacred experience going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
In Cleveland together. Oh, yeah.
And I said, like, it was closed. They opened it up just for me and him. And we went through there. And it was, and so he's got this podcast. So I'm going to go to his house and talk to him on his podcast. And I just wanted them to... Like, it's like with my parents, you just want to try somehow to impart your value system that, like, we made friends. You and I, we're friends now.
Yeah.
You're doing a podcast. My friend's doing a podcast. He wants me to do a podcast. It's what you do with a friend. I wanted them to, like, please understand that that it's not just money that animates Dad. Like, because they know, like, oh, you're going to do a con. That means money for, a semester of private school at the high school or whatever. And they know what work is, but I just want them to get my value system. Like you, and they already know with their friends, but I want them to know that that's important to me.
Well, that means a lot to me that you came here. You took your time. I think you're an unbelievable human being. And I love hearing your stories. Even Rob was intrigued.
Rob was sleeping. I thought he was going to start snoring.
No, I could tell he likes it. When he likes it, like, for instance, he was like, you know, taking pictures and taking videos and like, he really enjoyed the stories. Didn't you, Rob?
I did.
What was the biggest thing you'll take away today from?
I like the Goonies stories.
See, it's funny because I it's not that I steer away from like stories about working on certain things and I'm a fan like everybody else, mm-hmm. but you know, you've told these stories, but you know, I wanted to get inside and then I did. And then all of a sudden then these stories were like, they just took on, I don't know. They were really interesting is why I liked them. It wasn't like, I felt like I was there. I could picture the room. Yeah. I could picture the posters at Amblin. I could picture Spielberg's face and the glasses like on his nose. I could see him walking out of the room. I could see Donner going, okay, hey, let's do it again. I could see you looking at your pages. I could feel your heart beating in that scene. I could feel all those things. And like, you're a good storyteller. And I think that's why a big part why you're successful.
But what you did was what, I don't know who your audience is. It's probably mostly crazy people.
Yeah. Like me,
but,
they're all my crazies, right? Guys?
And there's probably like two of them, right? Like do you know how many people listen?
About six.
No, there's a lot of, we get about 150,000 downloads a week.
So what I love about the way that this little interview took shape is you could see that a life that had drama and pain in it also had exquisite joy. And I sort of think that's a good thing for people to be able to have reinforced for them.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today, Sean. It's been a real treat.
I loved having you inside of me.
I loved it. We're going to take a little video and some pictures and then we're good to go.
Buy,
I love you,
buddy. 150K. You're great.
So build that audience. Thanks for listening, guys.
The Rolling Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.